there. This is Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. It's a podcast about making things up and making things happen. Last week was part one of my 10th anniversary celebration. And to commemorate 10 years of Dennis Anyone, I had one of my past podcast guests, Robert Chandler. He's the filmmaker behind the documentary Dirty Sexy Comics. He's a longtime listener, and it was his idea to flip the script and interview me. So that's what we did. Last week was part one, and I didn't cry at all. But in part two, I think I cry multiple times. I am the John Boehner of podcasting. It's official. But, you know, that's all right. It's real. So there's that. All right. But before we get to part two, I want to remind you that there are two ways that you can support Dennis Anyone. You can go to my virtual tip jar at DennisAnyone.net and leave a tip in my virtual tip jar. Help me cover my expenses. I always appreciate that, and it always comes in handy. Or you can become a subscriber to DNR Studios. I'm part of a group of shows under the Derek and Romaine banner, and for a monthly fee, you get my show early, and you get all these other great gay shows. So check that out at dnrstudios.com. And here now is part two of the 10th anniversary of Dennis Anyone Flip the Script interview with me, conducted by Robert Chandler.
Is there an episode or interview you're most proud of? And if so, why?
Wow. I'm trying to think. You know, the first person that pops to mind is Dick DiBartolo, who was, because he is in two of my pop culture sweet spots, he was a writer on Match Game back in the 70s, and he worked at Mad Magazine. And I just like, and he's gay, and he talked about, you know, marrying his husband and how all the mad artists drew wedding cartoons for them. And like, I just, it married all of these things from my childhood in one person, and he's gay, and he's, you know, he's older, probably in his 70s now. That's something that comes to mind is like, wow, this is really special. I got to have that experience. There's a lot of people where I'm just like, wow. Like I Derek and Romaine, I'm part of their network with my show. And, I was doing the, I called Derek Romaine and I'm like, the show's so good. What can I do to make it, like, what can we do? Like, I really believe in it. Like, I just feel like the interviews have been so rich lately. I was like, what, you know, she's like, well, why do you think it's so good? I was like, well, I'm weeping often. I don't know. I find it really meaningful. And people like Mitchell Anderson, I got to talk to him about what it was like to be that great gay hope, like the leading man that comes out. And, you know, he, and the way he said he felt like, you know, he felt like he was welcomed, but then like not really helped by certain forces in the industry. And like, I find, and Craig talking about overcoming his addiction and being so hilarious. And, you know, and some of these ones where they're like, oh, this is going to be a two-parter. You know, talking about Madonna with Abdi Nazemian recently is something that I got to process my own experience of the concert and my own history with her and my story with his book and with somebody else. Like, it just, I find it very meaningful and healing, these conversations. I'm trying to think of people back in the day. Early on, I remember going to Kate Flannery's house and talking about, you know, she used to be a waitress at Kate Madalini before The Office, and how, you know, and what it was like. And I think the pride that she took in it, and just like what it was like for somebody to catch a big break like that and become a person that's on an iconic show, and where she was like before that. And like, that's something very memorable. There's so many, I can't believe how many interviews we've done. It's 10 years, baby. I kind of can't believe it.
After I heard that Mitchell Anderson interview, I bought tickets for The Inheritance immediately. And I would say it's the best play I've seen this century.
Wait, Bill Bronctrop was in Inheritance.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. I was like, wait. No, they were connected. No. Bill Bronctrop was
That's
in Inheritance.
Right.
Mitchell Anderson had his own show.
That's
But I
right.
think you went
That's
to that.
I did go
yeah.
to that.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that
yeah.
was great also.
Yeah.
But I did hear about The Inheritance from Dennis Anyone. And it was a life-changing experience.
I found it so profound. You know who I would love to get? Matthew Lopez, the writer of The Inheritance, on the podcast. I just thought it was, I think for gay men of our generation, it's just right there in that sweet spot where you
can't describe the emotion really, but it's just so powerful. I think it's sort of like, oh, this is what we went through. I think like there's a lot of things in the culture now where we're processing things that we weren't really ready to process, especially related to AIDS. I think of the Madonna Live to Tell moment in her concert now. Like, it feels like now we can reckon with it in a different way. And it just, I don't know. It's just interesting how these things evolve.
Right, sure. And the Dick DiPartolo interview, the first podcast I ever listened to was Leo Laporte's This Week in Tech.
Oh, right.
And Leo would have Dick on the show every episode. And he, you know, was an amazing guy. He would review, you know, some new tech, and he would talk about his time at Mad Magazine. And he was just so warm and delightful and had the most wonderful stories. And I just loved him. But I didn't know he was gay until your podcast.
Oh,
and
thank you.
It just felt like getting to know an old friend in a deeper and more real way.
Right. And that he was gay and that it was always cool at Mad and like all of that stuff. Like that was really meaningful to me to hear about that it could all be integrated, that all our stuff can be integrated. And also he's somebody that I looked up to as somebody who's stayed really creative, really relevant, like doing stuff all the time as like, you know, in his 70s. And I'm like, oh, that's the kind of guy I want to be. And I think I asked him, I was like, what have you learned? And he was sort of like, don't take everything so seriously. Something like that he sort of talked about. So when I think when something seems overwhelming or stressful, I'm like, you know, what would maybe it's like, I'm not going to take it so seriously. It doesn't have to be so seriously, so serious.
And I'm a gay man of a certain age.
Right.
And it's so wonderful to hear these stories from these gay men from a generation before, because I owe them so much.
I mean,
you know, what he did at Mad, bringing his partner, just being out,
yeah,
made my life better, directly better. And, you know, he and all of those people of his age, whether they're alive or not, and the people who came before them gave me so much, you know.
Yeah.
Like, they don't even know me, but they gave me such gifts through their courage and their, yeah, honesty.
And there weren't that many of them. You're talking about how there weren't as many. Like, there's more. Like, another interview that comes to mind is Sam Stagg, who was the editor-in-chief of, like, Honcho and Mandate and all those porn magazines in the 80s. And he has a Substack called Did You Sleep With the Models? And, you know, he doesn't do Zoom, so we did a phoner. And he's got these stories about what it was like to work in those magazines. And the truth is, for the image, for the art, it's a collage of a bunch of magazines that he worked on, all of which I have in my closet. They were my own magazines, and I laid them out on the floor. And I'm like, I was just made sure they were the right, you know, titles and the years that he would have been there. And so, yeah, happened to have those handy. But yeah, I like to know. A big thing that I'm like is like, what's it like to be you? Like, what was it like to, you know, what was it like? You know, I don't think sometimes you don't have to ask a lot of words in your questions. You can just be like, what was that like? You know, and just see. Yeah, but there's been a lot of people, and I'm just like, wow, I'm so grateful that that happened.
You make podcast interviews seem effortless, but is it ever effortful? Have you ever had a bad interviewees, people you really disliked at some point, or guests that acted like hostile witnesses?
There was somebody not super long ago, and I don't want to say who it is, but and I felt like I was kind of struggling, and I said it to a good friend of mine, Glenn, who listens to all the episodes. I was like, he was kind of tough. And he goes, you know what? I listened to it. It sounded okay. It sounded okay. And I said, well, I cut a few things out. But like, I think, wow, this isn't the love fest I was hoping for. You know, there haven't been any like super cringy, like awful podcast interviews. You know what's interesting is sometimes the people, I've interviewed a few visual artists, and I've noticed with a few of them that they're the ones more likely to use ums or like, you know, where you kind of might have to do some editing. It's not so much what they're saying, but sometimes like the roundabout way things get said. I find that sort of interesting. But the content was great. It's just sometimes a little more work after the fact.
Your Glenn Hansen interview was absolutely great. He's an artist. He's such a talented artist. And it seems like having an artist on a podcast shouldn't work. But something worked. It was an absolutely compelling interview.
Thank you very much. Glenn is a super talented caricature, cartoonist, illustrator. I'm not sure what word he prefers, but I have three of his Olivia Newton-John images on my wall. And he sent me a Madonna as a bonus, the What's Up Doc images. And like, he's just so good at what he does. But also when you think of somebody like that, it's like, oh, you're doing the Golden Girls. Do you have to get the rights? Like, I'm curious, like, how does that work? Like, there's sometimes like nuts and bolts questions that I want to know. How did you get that song? Like there's sometimes there's like behind the scenes, like that couldn't have been cheap. Like things like that I'm just kind of curious about how it works. Like OnlyFans and Just for Fans. When I had Joel Sumlin on, I was like, how does that work? What's the difference? Is it a grind? How much money do you make? Like sometimes I'm just curious about how things work. Yeah.
Now, looking back, is there an interview that stands out as a turning point for Dennis? Anyone? Maybe was there a big celebrity get that made getting other folks easier? Or somebody who made you realize, like, yeah, I've kind of made it?
Well, I got to do Leslie Jordan pretty early on because he was doing a show at the Gay and Lesbian Center, and I got to go to his house. And it felt like, oh, he's a big star with an Emmy, and he's a delightful conversationalist, and the things we talked about were so interesting. And I reran that episode after he passed away a little while afterwards as kind of a tribute. And I remember leaving that interview and feeling like, oh, that felt like a step up in terms of, you know, higher profile name that people know, and also just like content wise, super entertaining, super dishy, you know. And like, I remember he said he was dating a Secret Service guy and that he was in love, and he showed me the Emmy and he had art in his play. You know, he's everything you want him to be. That was a big deal. And the other thing I would think of is when the pandemic happened, I wasn't really set up to do interviews over Zoom. None of us knew what we were doing. And I remember Jack Plotnick, my friend, was doing these crazy like sci-fi videos on YouTube, and they were like retro 70s musical numbers, dancing and lasers, and he's doing it at a mini mall in West Hollywood. And I think I was like, I'm just going to try to do a podcast with this, and I'll just put my recorder next to the computer and we'll see how it sounds. Like, it was really not great technically, but it was sort of like that transition to like, oh, how can this work remotely? And then ever since then, I've done most of my interviews over Zoom. And because of that, I've been able to get people that I wouldn't normally get. At first I thought, oh, I'm, you know, because I would schlep to people's houses. This was more like, okay, there's people that I was able to get that I wouldn't have been able to get otherwise from different places. I just did that interview with somebody in an airport in Amsterdam, you know, and they were waiting for their flight. So, yeah, so another turning point was going Zoom.
Do you have a dream guest you'd still love to interview?
Christian Cooper is on my list. I want to interview David Archuleta from American Idol because he was raised Mormon like I was, and he made a break from the church, but it sounded like it was a really painful journey, and I'm really proud of him, and I think he's really sweet and talented, and I'd like to talk to him about his journey. Like, those are two people that are on my my dream board for guests. That would be really, really cool.
Could it happen? Are you working on it?
I think I sent both of them a message through Instagram, but I haven't heard anything. So I don't know. I need to figure out another channel, perhaps.
Is there a little bit of Madonna in every episode? Is she the patron saint of Dennis Anyone?
Wow.
Well, because when you talk about Madonna, there's almost a shorthand, right? Like,
yeah.
You don't need to introduce your connection to Madonna. Like, you can just get into the nitty-gritty.
I guess so. Well, having Matthew Redmond on, who wrote the Encyclopedia Madonica, and digging deep, and we played a game at the end with my 45s for my jukebox. You know, my writing career began because I auditioned for her as a dancer and didn't get it, but wrote a story about it. And that started my career. So I think there's always a part of my whole career that is connected to her. And I got to tell her that at a roundtable interview. I got to interview her for Bedtime Stories for a magazine called Singapore Clio. And so there's like 12 journalists around a table and we all get like one or two questions. And I told her, I said, you know, I told her that I had a writing career because she rejected me as a dancer. And she said, oh, you took a negative and you made it a positive. And she was a little British, you know, and it was sweet. And it was cool that I was able to share that with her.
Do you already have your Madonna interview written for when she says yes to be on the podcast?
To be on the podcast? I would want to know about like this softer side of her that's coming out now since the health scare. I feel like a lot of the walls have come down. She's more honest. She's more vulnerable. You know, she talks in her show about, yeah, I used to blow people to have a place to live. And I think before that would be sort of a scandalous thing. And it just felt like, yeah, you know, I don't know. I just like, and I also have such an appreciation for what she was doing now that I understand it more clearly and I see the power of it and the, not just around gay issues, but sexuality generally. And how, you know, with Abney Nazemian on the podcast recently, he sort of landed on this idea that the opposite of shame is Madonna, like what she pushed it back against shame. That landed so powerfully with me. And so I think that would be interesting. I'm just so glad she's still here doing her thing, you know?
When you look at a lot of pop stars now that are really pushing boundaries, you kind of think, yeah, Madonna was doing that in 89. It's really great. But, like, we haven't come that far,
right?
Really. I mean, from what Madonna did, I mean, I love watching somebody like Lil Nas X, and he seems to be
I
do, too.
I would have loved to have interviewed him. I would still love to, but yeah.
The documentary on HBO about him reminds me so much of Madonna and the way his tour is theatrical, the way that the music means a lot to him, but the message in the music means a lot to him, but the clothes mean a lot to him, and the dancing means a lot to him, and the videos mean a lot to him. And it's all one big message. It's all one big piece of art. And I feel like there's been few people that have really been that ambitious or really worked to say something like Madonna besides him.
And he's like an openly gay, super flamboyant pop star with huge hit records. And he's doing like anal in his videos. Like he's doing, like, I love the way he would sort of play with shock and bait, you know, people on Twitter. He's like king of stuff on Twitter. Like, I love Lil Nas X. I think he's beautiful. And I would want to ask him, you know, like, I think he made the decision to come out with his career and stuff like that, but I don't think he was always like, oh, I'm going to be out and all this way. I think it was gradual. And I always wonder, like, what would the not out version of him been like? Like, if he had decided, oh, I'm not going to talk about my personal life, if he'd done George Michael and said, I'm not going to talk about my personal life, what would that look like? He wouldn't be doing any of the stuff he's doing now. Like, it's just so balls to the wall gay, which is amazing. So I don't know what that alternate version of him would have been like. Probably not as fun.
Maybe a lot like George Michael, who really paid a price.
He did pay a price. And I think it's heartbreaking.
It's truly heartbreaking.
He is so talented. He was one of my touchstones. And like, I still remember being in the car when I heard he died, having gone to a movie, I think on Christmas Day at Century City Mall, had just seen Hidden Figures. And Carrie Fisher had just died. Like, it was just, oof, it was a lot. George is heartbreaking, but gosh, what a talent.
What a talent.
Yeah.
On the podcast, have you ever said anything you regret, something you wish you could strike from the record, or something that made you cringe in the moment?
I will say this. I often cry, especially lately. My emotions have been very, like, close to the surface. And as it's unfolding, I think, oh, this is so embarrassing. Because the person's looking at me on camera, and I'm, like, shuddering. And then when I go to edit it, because you're not getting the visual, it's not that bad. So some I might tighten it up a little. Like if I'm shuddering for 10 seconds, I might like cut out five of them or something. But I'm like, it's not as going back to edit. It isn't as cringe inducing as it feels like as it's happening. But I also feel like if you're not going to tell the truth, if you're not going to be open, if you're not going to do it, then what's the point? I'm not getting rich. Like, I don't got nothing to lose. I really, you know, like, your question implies that people are listening. And I know intellectually that they are sometimes, but it doesn't always feel like that. It doesn't, like, there's no, like, oh, I said that thing and there's blowback and it got picked up. No one, I mean, you know, it's, I'm niche. Let's put it that way. I'm quite niche. So I've never said anything that blew up or anything like that. And I'm sort of used to that in my career. Like even when I was doing a lot of magazine work, there wouldn't be a lot of letters to the editor about my stories. Like I think they were entertaining. I think they were edgy at times, but I don't think it ever like nothing ever really blew up, you know? And when Anthony Rapp came forward and talked about Kevin Spacey, I was a peripheral part of that story initially when it broke, because in 2000, Anthony and I did a piece for advocate.com where we were sort of interviewing each other because we had both come out with CDs of music, and he told me that story then, and we left it in without saying who it was. So there's this big blind item about Anthony Rapp saying that this actor, you know, laid on him at this party. And I was, and it's all in there. Not a single soul called and said, hey, who is that? It's like, it didn't even happen. So I'm not, so the point is, I just don't think, and my, I don't, I'm not used to getting a lot of reaction to things that I do or say, even when I'm dropping a big bomb. But that was the way advocate.com, like that was the way the web was then. It wasn't, it was the stepchild of print. Like it was like, we'll do it on the website, you know? So people weren't linking to social media or anything like that. So it just kind of laid there. So yeah, I don't know if there's anything I wish I hadn't said or anything I cut out of an interview. Not that I can think of. Yeah.
You are that good.
Well, no, sometimes I'll cut things out because it might be going on a while, or they might have already said that, or it might be sort of dull or peripheral. But yeah, I can't think of anything where it's like, oh, we can't say that.
If they had paid more attention, that whole Kevin Spacey story could have broken years earlier.
It could have years earlier. Yeah, 2000.
Would you have Kevin Spacey on the podcast?
I wouldn't. I don't think I would. I interviewed him once for British Premier Magazine. Yeah, I don't, oh, I can't imagine it. I can't imagine, I don't know, maybe, never say never, but probably not.
I interviewed him a few times for terrible movies.
Oh yeah, what was it like?
He was very unfriendly and withholding. Like, I'm the one who had to sit through The Life of David Gale. Yeah. You could at least be nice to me,
exactly.
Right?
He had a string of them.
K-Pax.
I think I interviewed him for Beyond the Sea, where he was Bobby Darin, and you could tell he was really into it. Yeah. Yeah, we did it at the patio of Orso. Driving around LA, I'm like, oh, that's where I interviewed so-and-so. I remember the restaurants and stuff like that. Yeah. Kate Mannellini, Elizabeth Hurley. We had two desserts. I remember like things like that. Remember Red on Beverly Boulevard? Jennifer Lopez.
Wow.
Yeah. I had J-Lo at Red, right there in a booth.
You do such a great job at shining the spotlight on your guests and fellow creatives. But we listeners have enjoyed the glimpses you give us into your life. Enzo,
your
evolving views on sex and religion, career challenges and triumphs, of course, a jukebox.
Right.
What's your philosophy on what you share and what you hold back?
I like to make the focus the guest. And so when I bring something about my personal life up in an interview, it's because I think it will spark something in the guest, and they'll say, oh yeah, I'm glad to hear that, or I relate to that, or I remember that too. So I do it selectively, not because I have like a million stories in my head and I'm just going to pick the ones or two, but they occur to me when it's germane, when it's sort of related to what we're talking about. And then I like to do the, so this happened at the end, where I kind of think about things that I'm, you know, experiencing, or things that I saw, or things that I'm dealing with, and they can kind of get a little heavier sometimes, or a little more personal. I like doing that. I don't feel like there are any consequences to this, so I just do what feels right. And also, I'm inspired by other podcast people when they are honest and vulnerable and open, and I always lean in. So I'm like, you know, if you're gonna do it, why not do it? Like, you know, I have a voicemail for this podcast, and I forget to give the number all the time. And occasionally I will get an email saying, you have a voicemail, because it's set up through Derek and Romaine and stuff like that. And I'm like, ooh, a voicemail. The last four or five times, it's been like static. It's like either been a hang up. Like, in other words, like the back and forth is there, you know, there's not an outcry.
No obscene phone calls.
No obscene phone calls, but just like, ooh, a voicemail. And then it's like, for 7 minutes, you know. But you can call my voicemail now if you want to. I'm looking at the number right now. 1-888-647-9653.
Which spells Call Dennis. Right?
I wish it does. I wish. No, yeah, it should. Yeah, but so yeah, I guess the point is I don't worry too much about saying the wrong thing or revealing too much. Yeah, because I haven't really done a thing where, ooh, that blew up in a bad way. I haven't had that.
I remember a real big moment for me as a listener listening to the podcast. I remember exactly where I was when I was listening.
Oh, my gosh.
Driving into the spot, the parking lot for LAX, which is so horribly inconvenient. It's
right
away. You have to take a shuttle. But I remember trying to find a parking spot at the spot. And it was the end of one of the Dennis Anyone podcast episodes, and you shared some stories about a brush you had with addiction, and you really put yourself out there. It was courageous, and I really felt close to you at that moment because of it. Well, not just that moment, but
right. But there's a thing that happens when people do this in this medium, right? You lean in a little. There's something unique about podcasts, I think, because I've experienced it with other people, and I was like, oh. It's powerful when you do that. I, as a listener, I'm enriched, so I'm going to be a little more brave in that way. So that's interesting that you remember that. I think it might have been when I interviewed Sam Pancake. I'd interviewed him a couple of times, and we were talking a lot about sobriety and things like that. And I, during that period of time after the Fashion Police strike, when I was trying to get a handle on my health. It was very physiological, very nervous system-y. It was like my body was like whack-a-mole. Like this thing would be off and then it would move over here. It was just crazy. And I took Klonopin for about 6 weeks to try to see if it would help. And it's a benzodiazepine. And I had taken it probably in 2009 during another period of unemployment. And with the doctor's, you know, supervision, and it helped me, and I got a job, and I went off it, and it was all good. So I thought, I'm going to try this again. Well, this time when I decided, you know what, I don't think this is working, I'm gonna go off it. I couldn't come off it. I was having these brain zaps, like it was like I can't do this, and I was like, I need help with this. And so I went to the hospital, and because of the nature of what the situation was. The course that was sort of prescribed for me to deal with it was rehab. So I went into a hospital for 3 days to sort of detox or to try to get out of my system. And let me tell you, I fell apart in that hospital. There was a chaplain that came in, and I'm not sure what religion. He gave me this little book, and he had spray that smelled like lavender. I remember that. And I just fell apart. And even though, like, I don't have a history of drugs and alcohol, I've never done it. Partly, I think, because I never felt like my place in the world was safe. And I can't fuck up. I have to be responsible. I can't go to Palm Springs and come back dumber. And, like I just – that felt like a non-starter for me. Anyway, and so I those weren't my issues in terms of a lot of the other people that I encountered. But I did need a place to fall apart. And it was valuable to be in that world for those. And, you know, and I went to like 3 or 4 meetings a week. I had friends come in for family day. And like I did the thing. And it was really interesting. And I felt like as it was happening, I was like, I'm always going to remember this. This is like a defining thing in my life because it was so out of character and it felt so extreme. I'm always going to remember. I'm the guy that went to rehab. And I very rarely think of it. But it was I remember people from it. I remember kind of what it was like. I remember I was good at it in terms of like I felt like I was good at giving feedback to other people and talking to them because I'm used to interviewing people and listening to people. I felt like I was valuable in those rooms in some ways. The saddest thing about it was there was a guy named Peter who was a young kid, young gay kid in his 20s, sweet, cute, and really struggled. And we did a few things together. We went to the movies. We went to one of the Mission Impossibles. And he left me a message and he had a girl name for me, you know, like the young gays do. And we had a few meals together and I tried to help him. And then I remember being working on a cruise ship a few months later and I got a message from one of the other gals that was in the program with us, who I really liked. And I knew instantly, I was like, Peter passed away. And sure enough. And it was like this young gay guy that I was trying to sort of help. And, you know, it was heroin. And wild, like that happened. And I still have a message from him on my phone that I won't delete it. But that was the thing that happened. That was the thing that I experienced, you know? I can't believe it. There's a lot of things about my life when I look back, I kind of can't believe. I'm going to share something else. Listened to the Beyonce album recently, like a lot of people. Cowboy Carter. I feel like James Austin Johnson imitating Trump. Cowboy Carter. Like, you know how he does. He's so good at it. Anyway, so I'm you know, it's incredible. The ambition of it, the scope, like you just kind of can't believe it. And the ballad with Miley Cyrus is Two Most Wanted. There's a lyric in it that goes, I'll be your shotgun rider till the day I die. And in the 90s, I used to write and record music. And I put out an album. I worked with a producer for years named Norman Arnold. And we put out an album in 2000. And one of the songs on it is called Shotgun. And it's about riding shotgun with somebody. And like, it's cute. And I haven't listened to it in the album. In like 7 years, maybe. I haven't listened to it. And I was thinking about this Beyonce song, and I was like, I'm gonna listen to that song. And just seeing, you know, what the lyric parallels are. Just like I was inspired to do that. And I brought it up on YouTube Music or Spotify, and I'd never seen the cover in that digital format on my phone. I was like, oh my God, I'd never seen that. I don't know, it struck me. And then I started listening to the song and the album, and I cannot believe that happened. I cannot believe I did that. And I thought I might be a little embarrassed to hear it or not the best. And I was so proud of it. And I think about that I did that. I made that happen. I spent my own money on it. And you know, it was kind of, maybe it was a vanity project, but like I listened to the vocals and I'm like, that kid meant it. Like there was a sincerity to it. And I guess I had so much distance because it's been so long since I considered it that I was really kind of proud of it and struck by it. And, you know, some songs are better than others and this and that. But I remember like, oh my gosh, this is where my friend Tom Geyer played this amazing piano solo right here. And, oh, this is where that thing. And I remember working with the vocal coach on that line. And, you know, it was just like this ghost of a thing that happened. And I, you know, I generally, like, I'm in a very precarious place right now. I don't know how I'm going to make a living, really. But I look back at what I've done and the pivots I've made, and I kind of can't believe it. I'm really proud. I kind of can't believe all the shit I did. And I don't look back and go, gosh, I wish I could have been this person or that person, or I never made it. I never broke through. I'm not bitter at all like that. I kind of can't believe what the stuff I've done. I'm like, holy shit, that happened. And I find it very moving, and I'm very proud of it, and also lost. So it's an interesting thing, but I'm not sure what the question was that inspired that thing, but it was like going back and listening to that again was really surprising. I thought I would be a little cringy about it, and I wasn't. I was like, oh, wow, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. And the voice was not flashy or, you know, I'm not, you know, you know, big vocalist or anything, but there was a sincerity to it that came through, and I was struck by it. So
it must be interesting connecting with your younger self, almost having a dialogue with your younger self.
Yeah, because like a few weeks ago, I think you probably listened to this. We did the reunion of the American Center for Musical Theater workshop people, and that was the thing that brought me to LA and listening to those people again and thinking back to that time. And during the interview, I think we talked about what would you tell your younger self. And I don't think I answered it in the interview. I think other people did, and then we got off to some sidetrack. So I was thinking about that after. I wouldn't tell him anything because I don't want to mess it up. Like, he believes, and he's doing a bunch of shit. If he knew how hard it was, he would, you know what I mean? Like, I go with God. Like, I don't think I would tell him anything, my younger self. In terms of creativity and career and stuff like that, I look back and I'm like, fuck. And then he was like, I was throwing like wild parties, and I would send out flyers, and my Christmas cards were like productions. Like, I kind of can't believe it. So I don't think I would tell him anything. He was really creative, really fired up, really believed, was really into the stuff that he did. Is this the part where I talk about myself in the third person? I don't know. But just in terms of that question of what would you tell your younger self, I don't think I would tell myself anything.
No regrets.
No, I don't want to screw it up. I kind of can't believe that early run of shit. Some I got paid for, most I didn't. But I was into it all. And also the harder stuff too. The times when things had to pivot and like the reinventions and starting, you know, my business's LifeCast and the game You Don't Know My Life, and that grew out of like, I got to figure something out, you know? So the whole journey, I look back and I kind of can't believe some of it actually.
And you have so much of it documented in the podcast.
It's all there. Right. Yeah. And even like the Comedy Cash podcast with me and Tony, I went back and listened to an episode of that, like not that long ago. And I was like, this is hilarious. Like there was something really special there. So I'm proud of all of this stuff. Yeah, so I'm glad I don't have, I had brunch with somebody recently and we were talking about our younger days. And I think they were coming from a place where they described it as kind of being ego driven. Like they thought they were the golden person that was going to do this and that. And so the fact that they didn't was like a thing. I think because of my background of always feeling a little bit like I'm not supposed to be here, I don't have that thing of like, well, why am I not on TV? You know, like I aspired to those things, but I didn't feel like it was my birthright. I didn't feel like it was my destiny, you know? So I don't have that thing of, I know people that you sense that they're bummed that they weren't stars. I don't have that. Yeah.
What advice?
I have other things, but I don't have that.
What advice would you give to someone who wants to start their own podcast and go on this similar journey?
I think that I could have learned a few of the nuts and bolts more professionally. I kind of stumbled into it in terms of like the technical parts, and I guess we'll use these microphones. Like, I had equipment left over from Radio with a Twist, and somebody told me how to get on Libsyn, Liberation Syndicate, which is the podcast hosting company, and I did that. And for years, all the Comedy Couch, Tony is in one ear and I'm in the other because I don't know how to do the mixing. I would try to get the technical stuff better sooner. I got better when I joined with Derek and Romaine, but it was never my forte. I think it's a lot of podcasts come and go, and they don't maintain. And I've kept this going because it's so meaningful to me. So I think my advice is, if you pick a topic that means something to you, and maybe it'll become something that you really value doing, as opposed to like, oh, this is a career move, or maybe this is a chance to make some money, or something like that. But I would learn more about the technical stuff. There's other stuff around. I'm looking into like, should I try to get on YouTube? Is that a thing? You want to know the day I jump off the Hollywood sign when it's all over? When somebody says, you know, you should do this on TikTok, or what? Like, somebody tells me about TikTok, I'm like, all right, I'm out. You know, but yeah, I think there's a lot of probably how-to stuff out there that I could have benefited from. Like, even just this microphone, somebody was like, oh, that's the best microphone, and I got it, and it's the best microphone. You know what I mean? Like, so I stumbled kind of blindly with the technical stuff, but also find something that pick something that you would do for free, because you probably will be, and you know, I think you probably will be. It's or close to it. I do get some generous tips too from time to time, but yeah, it's not a big moneymaker.
Good advice.
Yeah.
You have a milestone birthday coming up.
Yes.
What does it mean to you to be a gay gentleman of a certain age in a world where youth is seen as such a value? What are the upsides of being a slightly older gay man? And what example do you want to set as a sodomite with some decades behind him?
Oh, well, I'm going to be 60. And just yesterday I was listening to one of my positive psychology happiness podcasts, and there was a woman about positive aging on there, and it drives her crazy. I don't know, remember the name. She was a professor, and she's in her 70s, I think, or 80s herself. And she says it drives her crazy when anyone, like casual ageism, like, well, you don't look it, or like any of that stuff. Like, she was sort of rallying against it. And as I'm like approaching 60, I'm like, I'm going to take a page out of her book and say, yeah, I'm turning 60. And I'm proud of it. I'm still here. Like, what are the alternatives? So I'm trying to like own the 60 of it all. And I think about retiring, and I don't know how, can you do that if you're a freelancer? Is there any, like, I don't know how any of this works. Like, you know, I think you think, oh, well, I've got time to figure it out, or something will click. And no, it's just going to be a lot of, slogging and pivoting, and then you're going to be 60. Yeah, I don't know, but I'm very excited because on September 28th, we're doing the 20th anniversary of the Mismatch game, and then my birthday is the next day, so we're going to have a party in the courtyard after the Mismatch game on the 28th. That's like my birthday party, so it's going to be a big... So I have to survive till September is the point. and it's going to be exciting. So yeah, what, I don't know. I'm not sure what this number means. Like, I think there's a part of you that thinks, okay, I haven't met somebody for a romantic partner. Maybe that ship has sailed or maybe not. But I have to behave as though it hasn't, if that's what, something that I want. And it is. It's not something I'm desperate for, but it is something that I want, would like. And I think professionally, you know, the opportunities do just get smaller. Because when I think of my magazine days and other things, older people called me and gave me the jobs. You know what I mean? Like, almost always. And I just don't know if some 30-year-old executive is going to go, get me the host of Dennis, anyone. Like, I just don't think it – I think people tend to shop in their peers or, you know, I don't know, people that are looking to bring people up or discover. And I'm lucky that I had a good deal of that in my 20s and 30s when I was in magazines and doing other things as well. I don't know what the future holds. I don't. I'm still fired up. I'm still really creative. And I feel like as an interviewer, I'm better than ever. And I love it more than ever, but I'm not sure what the next, you know, decade is going to be like. You know, do I stay in LA? Do I go somewhere else? I'm not sure. Yeah. So if you have any answers, feel free to leave them on my voicemail at 1-888-647-9653. I should have that memorized. The voicemail.
You should make it spell something.
I know. I should make it spell something. I should look into that. Also, it's my own fault that the voicemail has not become a phenomenon because I often forget to give the number.
On Rockstar, Dolly Parton's recent duet album, Dolly and Stevie
These
Nicks.
These questions are the best, by
are
the
they,
way.
Are they?
The
yeah,
best.
I think you'll like this one. Okay, so here we go. On Rockstar, Dolly Parton's recent duets album,
yep.
Dolly and Stevie Nicks ask the musical question, what has rock and roll ever done for you? So I'll ask,
okay,
what has Dennis Anyone ever done for you?
I will give you an example really quickly right off the top of my head. I interviewed Bill Brocktrop for The Inheritance, and I love the play. I knew him a little bit from around, and we worked through Facebook. We made it happen. After it was over, I sent the link to the publicist at the Geffen. So now I'm on their list. And so I got some press release information about Fat Ham. Well, Fat Ham is on my dream board. I want to see Fat Ham, but I can't pay full price. I'm not at that place. So I reached out to him, and I said, hey, I'm on the list, and I interviewed Bill Brocktrop for The Inheritance. I don't know if there's a press show, but if there is, I would love to come. And he wrote back and he said, well, it's actually this Friday night and it's full, but I think I could squeeze you in with the guest. So Dennis Anyone got me into Fat Ham for free. And that's just one example of these little dots that connect. Like I went to see Luke Yankee's play, Mom, Marilyn, and Me, a few months ago in Long Beach. He was on the podcast to talk about the play. And it was about his mother, Eileen Heckart, and Marilyn Monroe and their friendship and his thing and going down to Long Beach. And I brought a friend and it was an adventure. And I had a real connection to it because I had interviewed Luke. The tickets were free. Like the interviews make me feel connected, but then it's the after part that is enriching and connection. And we had an outing and we got to do something. It was really fun. And, you know, I did this podcast recently about the movie Transition, this documentary in Afghanistan about the man transitioning in Afghanistan. And I watched it while I was on vacation with some friends in Puerto Vallarta. And I watched it on my computer. I was like, do you guys want to watch this with me? And they're like, it doesn't sound like my thing. And I watched it and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to talk about this with somebody. Like, I was so enriched for having seen it. And I don't think I would engage with the works so much if the podcast wasn't this vehicle for me to discuss them and connect with the people. Like Tim Murphy's novel, Speech Team, and Krista Dora, and Correspondence. I'm obsessed with all of those books. And because I have this forum, I'm able to not just enjoy them, but to follow up on that or find out where is that church that you wrote about in this book and I want to go visit. And now it's on my dream board. And it's like, it's this rich, it makes life so much richer. Like, I can think of a million stories like the Fat Ham thing. Well, because of that, I knew that or whatever. And it makes me feel connected to people. It makes me feel connected to people. And I do believe that art and creativity make the world go around. For some people, it's sports. For some people, it's, you know, the outdoors, whatever it is. For me, it's these things, these, you know, books, writing, movies, television, music, like that kind of the arts. And they make life bearable. And this podcast is a chance to not just shine a spotlight on people that are doing it, but to celebrate it and to also bring more of it into my own life. Because, you know, in 2020, right before the pandemic hit, I kind of took stock of my life and I was like, okay, I'm not working enough or making enough money. I'm not in a relationship. Trump is president. And I had all these things that were true.
What could be worse?
I had all of these things that were true. And I thought, this was 2020. I thought, okay, what if all those things are true and I could be happy anyway? That's the work. That's the project. And I started studying positive psychology and then the pandemic hit. And I thought, well, that's a great motto for this year because that's really, we're all messed up. So while I was sort of learning about the science of happiness and trying to start to incorporate some of these things into my life, the pandemic happened and I got through it because I was able to, you know, find joy in smaller things that weren't really about success or status or it's so cliche, but, you know, and I started doing my gratitude list, and that's such a powerful thing. I'm a little bit of a woo-woo about it, but like, it's part of why I was so interested in this program that I wanted to apply to, and I still might. I would still like to. It's so expensive, but maybe I'll win the lottery. But anyway, I remember I started doing the gratitude list during the pandemic, and it was like a couple months in, and my friend Matt had texted me, and he said, "What are you doing right now? I ran out of gas. Can you come and get me?" And I was like, "Yeah, I can. I'm not doing anything." And so I'm driving to get him on Ventura Boulevard and take him, you know, where he needs to go or whatever. And I'm like, "Oh, this is going to be number one on my. This is going on my gratitude list. In fact, it might even be number one." And I was like, "Why? Because it's not. I'm not getting anything. It's not a big windfall for me." But it was undeniably number one. Like, it just was like, I think this practice has changed the way I think and what I value. And it's not like you better put that at number one, Dennis. It's automatic. Like, it's kind of wild how your brain can sort of change. And those tools have been very valuable to me. And so appreciating things like, you know, I wish my podcast were more successful. I really believe in it. I think the content is great, but I'm not like, why am I not them? Like, you know, although Smartless, give me a fucking break with Smartless. Like Sean Hayes posted when Smartless got picked up for a gazillion dollars or whatever. He's like, you know, big day for the little podcast that could. I don't know if they said big day, but it was the little podcast that could. I'm sorry, Smartless is not the little podcast that could. You know, I'm sorry. I went there, but it's not. You know, they have they have an engineer. I bet they have an engineer. I bet they have people that do. I bet Sean Hayes is not writing his own synopsises. Do you think he is? Bateman? No. They breeze in.
They make Will Arnett do it.
Will Arnett. Okay, sure. Yeah, he's like, I do the synopsises. Yeah, but anyway, so I appreciate things for what they are more, and this podcast is full of those things all the time, every interview, every one. Even when my nervous system was a mess and I would do those interviews for those period of times, I was in a better place. I was good. And I look at all the different people that I've interviewed and I see somebody like, you know, signed a new deal. Oh, I interviewed them. Or like, it's fun to like this stable of talented people that I got to talk to and also got to celebrate. I feel like I honor them by paying attention to them and asking about their work in a way that I think has substance and fun to it.
How do you want Dennis Anyone to be remembered 100 years from now?
Let's see.
What do you want your legacy to be? What do you want the legacy?
You know what? I'll say what it is. You know, I have guests on the podcast that are straight, or you know, or I also have women on the podcast. But I think for gay men of a certain age, it's almost like an archive of a lot of our creative stories, a lot of our like that little niche. I could see some of these episodes living at like the One Archive or something like that in terms of gay history. Like, I feel like that's something that the focus of what I do could be something valuable in a way that, you know, would be searchable if you were like looking for, you know, what was Leslie Jordan like, or, you know, what, you know, Ron Nicewan are talking about Philadelphia and things like that. Some of the people that I've gotten to interview, and also just what it was like to be a gay creative at this time in history. Yeah.
You often tell your guests that the next question is the last question.
I do that a lot.
And then you go on to ask them a few more last questions.
I mean, do that all the time.
I get it. Your interviews are so good and the guests are so interesting that I don't want them to end.
Oh, thank you.
And I feel the same way about Dennis Anyone.
Oh,
and
thank you.
So here's hoping that you keep putting off the last question for a long, long time.
That is so sweet. That's so thoughtful. And I like that you couched it in the lingo of the podcast, because that does happen a lot. Like, that I'll ask them and then they'll think of something. And then I'll think of something. I was like, wait, you know. But I will tell you this. I think about the last question. I think about what I want it to be. And I think, what might get them to say something really nice to sum things up? What's something that might really land and be meaningful and will be a nice way to go out? And when those deliver, when I'm like, oh, yeah, that's sweet. Because I think a lot of interviews don't do that. Like, they just sort of end, or like, you know what I mean? Like, a lot of your average, you know, news interviews that you'll hear or whatever, even like the feature interviews that somebody's showing up on Access Hollywood or whatever. But I do love that moment when, or when I blow it, I'm like, I thought that would be good and they got nothing. Shit. Like, but I do think about that, and I do hope that it wraps it up nicely in a way. And when it does, I'm like, still got it.
You definitely got it. Thank you for letting me do this.
Thank you for doing this and putting so much thought and love and care into it. And, you know, like, when I get frustrated or feel like, ugh, what am I doing? I'll see you and we'll go to a movie or something, and you'll talk about an episode, and you'll talk about my podcast in ways that, like, that is very thoughtful and deep, and like, you know, you get what I'm going for, and that means so much to me that it lands, that somebody, you know, it's very powerful when somebody sees you the way you want to be seen. It's very meaningful. It doesn't happen a lot, I think, for anybody. So when that happens, you're like, oh, you cherish it. So thank you.
Thank you for 10 years.
10 years. 10 years. Thanks again to Robert Chandler for conducting the interview and just supporting the podcast for all these years, always giving me great feedback about it, just being a huge champion of mine, and it really means a lot. I also want to thank all of the other listeners who have enjoyed even one episode, even one clip on Instagram of a 30-second quote. If you've enjoyed or supported Dennis Anyone over the last 10 years, I really, really appreciate it. And of course, all my guests for being so awesome and open and fun. All right, so this happened. Well, two things happened, and one is related to the podcast. The other isn't so much. But, you know, talking about what the podcast has brought to my life with Robert, it made me reflect on, like, little things that, oh, that's because of the podcast. Oh, I saw that show because I interviewed the guy. Like, there's a million of those things in my life. And one of the craziest things that ricocheted off the podcast recently is I had a luncheon last week with other fans of the movie Xanadu. So a few weeks ago, I was a guest on the Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife podcast, hosted by my friends Dave White and Alonzo Duraldi, both film critics. And we did a deep dive into the movie Xanadu, which is one of my favorites and very close to my heart. And so they let me play the episode on my podcast as well. So a friend of mine named Rustin is a fan of Xanadu as well, and he heard the podcast, and he knows a lot of other Xanadu fans. He, too, is a fan of Xanadu. And he's been wanting to sort of get us all together, but it was the podcast that was, like, lit the fire. And so he arranged a lunch at his workplace. And so I knew, like, one or two of the people there, but there were, like, I don't know, 8 or 10 of us that came. And there was a guy there that I know a little bit named Larry Bloom, who was actually in the movie. He's a dancer, and we saw some pictures where he was behind Olivia, and he told stories about the movie. And there was a gal there who I had not met yet named Kira, literally named Kira, after the movie. Olivia's character in the movie is named Kira. So Kira's parents named her after the movie, and then she, growing up with that legacy, took it to her heart and is a huge fan of the movie as well. So she had some slides to show us on the wall, and she had an amazing story that still blows my mind to this day. So there is a club scene at the end of Xanadu, where they're at Xanadu, the club, and there's this light-up neon sign, of course, in the Xanadu font. Well, long story short, Kira found it online in an auction a couple of years ago and got it, and now it's hanging in her house. Can you believe that? I can't believe it. It doesn't light up anymore. The neon is obviously, you know, old and doesn't work, but it's all there. And it's not one piece. It's letter by letter. And luckily, they had all of the letters. She was able to buy it. So, yeah, that was quite a find. And everyone else in the Xanadu unofficial fan club meeting luncheon was just, like, salivating with envy. But it was so cool. And there were lots of little factoids that I learned about at the luncheon. And we're definitely going to do it again. It was so wild. And then there was this gal, Lisa, who is a singer, really a professional, accomplished singer. And she talked about how she sang Suspended in Time in, like, a talent show back in the day. I guess there was one of the 45s had a vocal free version of the song, so she was able to sing kind of like a karaoke track before those things were really readily available. So she sang Suspended in Time back in the day. Well, she stood up in front of the slide of the Xanadu sign, which is on Kira's wall, and brought up the track on her phone and sang Suspended in Time to us in this conference room. And I might play a little bit of it for you now.
But how can a love succeed? A miracle is what we need, and so I appeal to you to keep me suspended in time with you. Don't let this moment die. I am feeling without you.
How awesome was that? It was just transcendent. We were all just, like, swept away from this conference room into a place where nobody dared to go. And I asked Lisa if it was okay if I played that on the podcast, and she said sure, and I wanted to give her Instagram. It's Lisa Donahue Music. That's Lisa, L-I-S-A, Donahue, D-O-N-A-H-E-Y, Music, on Instagram, so you can hear more of her music. There was also a guy at the luncheon named Eric who started an Instagram account called Olivia Newton-John is a Doll, and he started dressing up dolls in Olivia Newton-John outfits. He would custom make the outfit, and he has all these dolls on Instagram, and they ended up becoming a book, and Olivia was able to get a copy, and I think they auctioned some off for her charity. Like, it's a whole thing. And there were a few other guys there that had a big Xanadu-themed party where they did giveaways. Just, it was a Xana love fest. And the thing is, the thing that lit the candle under Rustin's But to have this luncheon was listening to that podcast. He was like, all right, I'm going to do this. So another thing that came out of the podcast, which is amazing. And while I was there, somebody told me that they liked my haircut. Another thing that came out of the podcast. My haircut, I'm kind of doing a weird mohawk thing. You know, all the OnlyFans boys are doing it. It's, I thought I was too old to have fun with my hair. It turns out I'm not. But the thing is, the reason I have it is there was a podcast guest a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, an author named David Ambrose. He wrote a book called A Place Called Home about his journey through the foster care system. And it's just a wonderful memoir. And I went to see him read. And after the reading, I was looking at his haircut going, I want to do that. I think my hair might be able to do that. So afterwards, I was like, that was a great reading. Do you mind if I take a video of your head? And I literally did a 360 video of his head. And I gave it to my friend Anthony, who cuts my hair. And we've been rocking some version of that ever since, also because of the podcast. So see, things come into the world because of the podcast, the ricochet effect. And the other cool thing that happened doesn't so much have to do with the podcast, but it was really a thrill. So you all probably know that I co-created this party game called You Don't Know My Life, and we do the virtual game nights online. Well, we do in-person events as well, like team building events and friend parties and stuff like that. Just haven't done as many lately as we did back when we started pre-pandemic. Well, I have a friend and a mentor named Glenn Mazzara, who is a showrunner in television. He worked on The Walking Dead and Damien and many different shows. And he has a new show coming up. I can't tell you the network or the name of the show because it hasn't been officially announced, but it's kind of a fun, exciting show. And he wanted to play the game with his writer's room. So I went to their office and I brought all my equipment and my pads and my cards and my little lazy Susan. And we played the game with this writer's room. And it was so much fun. First of all, writers are great storytellers, naturally. So the stories were amazing and, like, jaw-dropping. And, like, you know, everyone was like, oh, that could be an episode. That could be an episode. It was, like, one of those things. And it was just so gratifying. I really admire and respect Glenn. And I was just so happy to go and do that. And so hopefully I'll be doing more of that because I really love it. So if you have an in-person group that you want to help bond and get to know each other and have some laughs and you're not far from Los Angeles, let me know. I'll come and facilitate a game for you. It's really fun. And so that was a total kick. So those are my two big things this week, the in-person game and the Xanadu Luncheon. I feel like we all want to get jackets made for the Xanadu jackets at the end that Sunny wears. Also, Kira had some insights about different versions of the ending, because when she got the Xanadu sign, there was other stuff that she got too, because it was like, you know, I think it was one of the producers, Joel Silver's stuff. Like, it was just, our heads were all about to explode in this thing. So thanks to Rustin for putting that together and for everyone for coming and sharing the Xana love, if you will. All right. Thank you for listening to these anniversary episodes and for your continued support. I love doing this podcast. And as I said in the interview, I'll stop it when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers. So thanks to Oscar Rosario for mixing the episodes. My theme music is by Mark Daniels for Placement Music. We'll catch you next time on Dennis Anyone. Bye.